If we would, just turn to Exodus 33. This is one of my favorite passages, favorite scriptures. It opened up a time in my life that was very, very dear to me. And last Thursday, LaRue began to just exhort and talk about the various levels of intercession that Moses went through during this time, and the effect and the power of that, not only in his life, but in the nation and in the nations. And so there was a divine revelation that was released there, but there was something that he didn't talk about that I want to talk about today, because it just something that grabbed my attention about it here. So if we're good, in Exodus 33, verse 13, it says, "Now therefore I pray thee, if I have found favor or grace in thy sight, let me know thy ways, that I may know thee, so that I might find favor or grace in thy sight. Consider also that this nation is thy people." For one thing we need to understand right off the bat, if you're reading King James, it'll say grace in those scriptures. The word grace and favor in the Old Testament were exactly the same word. So it was interchangeable depending on how they chose to render it. But so grace applies here in this thing that he's talking about. Grace applies here. So let's also go into verse 14. And he said, "My presence shall go with you, and I will give you rest." My presence will go with you, or I believe in the King James, will go with thee, and will give thee rest. And what he's trying to say here is what happens when grace comes upon our life. When we begin to engage grace, there's a presence that comes with us. There's a presence that begins to surround us and be carried with us where we go. There's something that happens out of that presence and that grace being upon your life. You're given the opportunity to enter into His rest. An opportunity to enter into His rest. And so before I say a whole lot more about all that, I want to just recognize something, and we'll go ahead and just turn to 1 Peter 5. 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 5. Because I want to recognize something. Most of us are in a state of unrest. See, most of the time, the devil's number one tactic against us is through care, worry, anxiety, fear, those kind of things. He wants to burden us down and keep us down and keep us depressed. And you know what? He has more than enough attacks to launch against us to keep us continually in that place if we'll allow for it. Some of the things that he wants to do is he wants to create torment through fear. Sometimes that torment actually becomes something that actually begins to people begin to have dreams. You know, you've ever woken up from a dream and you were running and you're going through this stuff and the boogeyman was coming after you and you couldn't move, this torment. But see, that torment is also very real in our lives if we'll let it be. The torment comes through the fear of lack, fear of people, fear of an intimacy. It comes through poverty. There's torment in those things. There's torment and pain and sickness. And that torment is something that, it's a battle that we continually look at, and we have to recognize in this battle, number one, the battle belongs to God. We battle sickness, we battle disease. We see battles in our families and battles in our finances. All those result in us taking cares and burdens upon ourselves. And results in us taking upon ourselves a weight and a responsibility that we weren't supposed to. I know, that's really good news. But if you don't define what it is that we're looking at, if we don't define what these cares actually do to us, how can we know and begin to understand how to get out of it? How can we begin to even understand the importance for getting out of it? And I want to tie all this back to grace. I want to tie all this back to the rest. Because the importance is that we have to recognize that we're in a battle and recognize that oftentimes the very thing that gives the enemy any weight whatsoever is the fact that we don't battle against him. We don't even recognize if somebody has an issue going on in their life, a severe addiction, then we recognize that as a battle that needs to be fought against. But when we get anxious over our finances, we don't even see that as a battle. We don't even see that as improper. We don't recognize, we underestimate what the enemy's doing to us. 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 5. I'm going to start halfway through. Well, I'll just start the first of the verse. You younger men, likewise, be subject to your elders, and all of you clothe yourselves with humility one toward another. For God is opposed to the proud, but gives grace to the humble. There's that word grace again. Humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God. Why? Because God is giving grace to the humble. God's giving grace to the humble, therefore we want to humble ourselves under His mighty right hand. That He might exalt you at the proper time, casting all of your cares or your anxiety upon Him because He cares for you. See, it's not until we begin to recognize that He cares for us, and if He cares for us, then we can cast those cares upon Him, that we begin to understand where we can go with this. We have to understand that when we have cares in our life, when we allow cares to control our life, then we're making ourselves devourable by the enemy. The enemy has every right to devour us if we place our trust in our cares. Now, we'd never say we're placing our trust in our cares, but when we spend all our time in anxiety and fear and worry, what are we placing our trust in? What are you giving voice to? What are you talking to your neighbor about? You're placing your trust in your care instead of in God. You're recognizing that this is so in your life instead of recognizing what the Word said. So those are the things that we're looking at there, is that cares make us devourable. You know, sometimes that care comes just a simple rejection. It's one of the cares that comes. We'll do all kinds of things to avoid being rejected. I've been working with a few individuals, and a whole bunch of individuals have this same issue, but I'm thinking of a couple in particular where their whole life has been defined by their attempt to avoid rejection. One person's attempt basically involves him getting so involved in something else, even though it's an okay thing, it's just a sport, but getting so involved in something else simply so that he doesn't have to have those true interactions of the soul with anybody around him. Whenever there's trouble in his life, he goes and plays games. That in itself is not a problem. But the fact is, he's avoiding the issues in his life. He's avoiding any true interaction with other individuals by doing this thing. Another individual is deep into an addiction that he does not want to be in, and he hates the addiction, but his only way of redemption, the only way of experiencing any kind of a real intimacy, is to do these other things. All to avoid because of rejection. Because rejection is defining how he sees himself and how he sees the world around him. And in that definition, there's nowhere else for him to go but just to go into an addiction. That's the way he sees his world. So many times we'll do something that's totally illogical and we know it's illogical, just so we don't have to face somebody's lack of acceptance. So we don't have to walk out and tell somebody truth. And I understand. We talked about truth last week. Truth is a scary thing. But it's also the thing that can help you mature. It's also the thing that helps you grow. The truth when it's spoken in love, the truth when it's received, is the very thing that sets you free. We began to understand last week how grace is a revelation, basically, of how to be manifested as a son or a daughter. It's the how you become manifested as a son or a daughter, as an inheritor. But here we're looking at the cares, and it says the cares consume us with worries and anxieties and fears, but it requires our permission. See, fear is the catalyst. It's the thing that causes you to try to do something. It wants to force you to do something. But you have to give it permission in your life. You have to give it access. We're back to that place where we have to understand that the power that the Lord has given us, the exousia power He has given, is greater than the power of the enemy. His exousia power is greater than all the dunamis power that the enemy has put into your life. And when we understand that, then it gives us authority in it, because we no longer have to fall into his trap. We no longer have to fall into agreement with whatever fear or your circumstance or your family or whatever else is going on is trying to tell you about. We don't have to give the enemy that permission. It goes on here, it says, verse 7, casting all your anxiety, all your care upon Him, for He cares for you. Be of sober spirit, be on the alert. Your adversary, the devil, prowls about like a roaring lion, seeking someone to devour. But resist him firm in your faith. Resist him firm in your faith. See, resisting the care is resisting the devil. When we resist the temptation to go and worry and dive into the mirror of fear of our finances, or dive into the fear of facing that person, or dive into those things that are going on, when we resist that fear, then we're resisting the enemy. When we don't submit ourselves to the power of the rejection, then we're resisting the enemy. When we don't submit ourselves to the fear of what the situation is bringing, oftentimes it's not really the situation itself as it is the fear that the enemy tries to create with it. I mean, none of us are immune. I know that there have been mornings when I would lie awake in the morning simply because, you know, there was a time where I'd lost my job and I would lie awake in the morning looking and seeing myself underneath a bridge, hoping that there was somebody who would pay attention to me. Now, there was no reality in that. But that's what the fear, where the fear wants to take you. That wasn't the situation we found ourselves in, but that's where the fear automatically takes you. Sometimes some people get so busy looking at where that fear, where the enemy wants to take them, that they get overwhelmed and they fail to do the very thing that they need to do to take care of business right now. And thereby bring it to pass. It's sometimes not so much the issue as it is what the fear is trying to make you see. It's the lies and the deceptions that the enemy has tried to put before you. Sometimes we can take on fears based on something that happened in the past and based on an unrealistic view of that. Because if we can see something in the enemy makes us look like it's, no, that's all your fault. And we take the burden of it. Instead of recognizing that that's not even how it happened. We want to recognize today that victory is not found in fighting the circumstance. It's not found in dealing with all the symptoms. The victory is in all things. The victory is going to be found in looking and identifying the root. Until we identify the root, we're never understanding what we're actually up against. The thing I've told you in many different ways, but basically is this, is that we don't deal with the fruit, we want to deal with the root. The circumstances in our life are nothing more than a fruit, but they're not the root. And so the Lord shows us how to deal with the root, and that's going to be found over in Hebrews 4 and 11. You'll recognize these scriptures. And here in Hebrews 4 and 11 it says, let us therefore be diligent to enter that rest, lest someone fall through following the same example of disobedience. Here he's instructing us to labor in to enter into the rest. If you're going to expend effort to enter into his rest. See, what we have to do is recognize that our fight is not with the devil. Recognize that the problem is that we gave authority to the enemy over our lives. We gave that authority. How? We gave that authority by coming into agreement with him. We gave that authority by not taking our cares and submitting them to the Lord. Because see, when we take our cares and we begin to submit them in the Lord, then we can actually enter into his rest. When we enter into his rest, then there are some wonderful things that happen on our behalf. See, entering into that Sabbath rest that the Lord has promised us, that's the antidote to your cares. It's the antidote to your cares. Let me define what I'm talking about when I'm saying rest. When I'm saying rest, I'm not saying to be a couch potato. To sit here and flip the channels and do nothing and go, oh, God's got it all taken care of. That's not what we're talking about. When we're talking about entering into the rest, we're talking about entering into a relationship with the Lord. We're talking about coming into a dependence upon God rather than upon self. That's rest. We're talking about recognizing his strength to do the things that we cannot. That's rest. As we recognize his strength to do those things that we cannot, as we come into a place of understanding our dependence upon him, we're no longer dependent upon ourselves. We're no longer having to generate an answer to all the situations in our life for ourselves. Sometimes we look at those things when the way these things get taught, people begin to think, well, I don't have any responsibility. That's not the point. That is not the case. You have a responsibility to put forth effort. You have a responsibility to engage God. You have a responsibility, but the deal is you no longer have to carry the weight of the problem. Because that belongs to him. When we no longer have to carry the weight of the problem, now that sets us free to actually spend our time and our energies doing and focusing on something that's truly important. Focusing on that which will actually begin to prosper us. Focusing on that which will actually begin to overcome our situation. Being not overwhelmed by the situation any longer, but being able to partake and to excel because God is with us. That's the thing that we need to understand. He is with us. And then until we give him the freedom and give him the place in our life, then we can't begin to overcome because we haven't even begun to engage him yet. So when we begin to engage him, when we begin to enter into his rest, you're engaging that which is going to set you free to do the greater good. To do that which you couldn't do on your own. See, grace also being that power of God to accomplish his will in your life. There's no way you're going to accomplish his will in your life by yourself. We understand that when it comes to salvation, that we can't do that. But see, everything else, we want to say, well, I got it, Lord. There was a joke, this guy, he was a farmer, and he was up on the roof, and he was nailing in some shingles, and all of a sudden, something happened, and he slipped, and as he's sliding down the face of the roof, going towards the ground, and he's on the second story, so it's going to be a long fall. As he goes, help me, God! And just a few seconds later, as he's going and sliding over the edge, his bib overalls get caught on a nail on the side. And he says, never mind, I got it. See, we all think we got it. We don't realize we're still dangling in the air. And that God's provision has been there for us. And all he's looking for us to do is just turn towards him. He's just looking for us to engage him. You know, it's so much easier instead of getting on overwhelmed if we just allow ourselves to submit the care and the worry. Submit the past and the present. Rectify the future with what he says and what his word is instead of what the fear was. Because in the recognizing of the word, and you begin to confess the word over the situation rather than rehearsing Because so much of what we do when we're in worry and anxiety and fear is we rehearse the problem. There have been a few times when I had to tell somebody when they came up to me for the third or the fourth or the fifth time about the same thing. I said, please, don't rehearse the problem. It doesn't usually make them feel good, but it does at least wake them up. But so much of what we do is rehearse the problem rather than rehearsing a solution. Our solution is only going to be found in God. Our solution is not going to be found in our own energies and strength. We can come alongside and we can let God work in us and through us. That's what we should be doing. But we should also recognize that our dependence is upon Him. Our finances and our home are not just about us. It's about God. Our past is not just about what happened, but it's also about what are we going to see it now? How are we going to see it now? And what are we going to allow it to continue to control the future, or are we going to allow it to be what it is, the past? By submitting it to God. You know, in the past, I did a lot of things I'm not proud of now. But the deal is that's over. The choices I make now are up to me today. As long as I don't continue to make choices out of those same things and do the same choices, then today I can begin to be a new person and to be the person that God is telling me to be today. I don't have to be controlled by the past. We want to engage His strength to do the things that we cannot. If you'll just back up here, it says verse 9. Verse 9 says that there remains, therefore, a Sabbath rest for the people of God. For the one who has entered his rest has himself also rested from his works as God did from his. Romans 11 and 6, we don't have to look it up right now, but it says, if by grace, then it's no more of works. If it is by grace, then it's of no more of works. When we begin to enter into His rest, what we're entering into is His grace. And I'm going to show you that more and more in just a few moments. But we're entering into His grace by entering into His rest. Let's back up to chapter 3 and verse 11. Because I want you to recognize something. See, this passage here in Hebrews 4, He's been talking about the rest of God for quite a while. From Hebrews 3 and 11, where He says, and as I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest. All the way down through the end of chapter 4, He's talking about the rest of God. He's talking about the rest of God, entering into the rest. Why we enter the rest, what the rest is. I want you to just look with me at verse 19. What does he say here? He says, and so we see that they were not able to enter because of what? Unbelief. Now this was a nation who had sinned exceedingly above and beyond all that was thought or think. Iniquity was great within the camp. And yet he said they didn't enter in because of unbelief. Your access is not being blocked by your sin. That's the message. Your access is not being blocked by the iniquity. Your access is being blocked by your failure to believe what God has provided for you. That one right there is worth the price of admission. Because see, so often we start to come before the Lord and we think, oh, I can't do that because I've got this sin thing in my life. He says, it's your unbelief. That's the only thing that's blocking you from coming and entering in. Coming into this grace that I've given for you. The issues that we have, we can freely bring to Him. He goes on to elucidate that more in chapter 4. We've done that before. He gives you more and more examples of what it is and why He wants you to come, but I want you to see something before we do that. Chapter 4, let's look at this. It says, verse 11. I want you to just read with me. Therefore, be diligent to enter that rest, lest anyone fall through following the same example of disobedience. Disobedience and unbelief are cousins. They're kissing cousins. They're the same root word forms both words. But anyway, verse 11 says, let us therefore be diligent to enter that rest, lest anyone fall through following the same example of disobedience. Now flip over to verse 16. Let us therefore draw near with confidence to the throne of grace, that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need. This is his summation of what it is to means to deal and enter into the rest. When we find something that says therefore, we need to look and see what it's there for. And when it's there for, it's going to refer to something that's already gone on before, something that's already been discussed. Well, for a chapter and a half, we've been discussing the rest of God. Immediately before that is the verses that say this. They talk about Jesus being your high priest. And because he's your high priest, he's already experienced everything that you've experienced, and yet he did not sin, and he comes, and he chooses to make intercession for you. He chooses to give you an opening and an access into the very throne room of God. But then we notice that it says, since then, when it first starts, verse 14, it says, since then, we have such a great high priest. Since then means that there's something else that went before it. And before it was a process where it backs up and he talks about in Hebrews 4 where the word is sharper and active than a two-edged sword. And it's dividing asunder the very thoughts and intents of the soul and the heart, the spirit. It's all being divided along. And then everything is being open and laid bare. Verse 13, everything is open and laid bare before him with whom we have to do. Because what he's expressing is that there's nothing that happens under the sun that God does not know about. And rather than that being a cause for us to fear and to tremble, it's a cause for us to rejoice because he knows who you are. He knows who you are. He knows where you're at. He sees the things that you do, and it's a place of rejoicing when you know that you're doing what you're supposed to do. And it's a place of freedom when it's something that you know you're supposed to not, because he already sees it. So the only person you would be possibly hiding it from would be yourself. So why not bring it to him, knowing that he is our great high priest and his only desire is to bring us into the place of access with him, into the place of the very throne room where the exchange can take place. And that which was on you can be put off, and that which God has for you can be put on. Where you can begin to come underneath that covering of his rest, that covering of his presence, that covering of his life, and you can begin to yield those things in your life that didn't need to be there in the first place. The things that you didn't find fulfillment in at all. I can tell you, I remember there were so many things I thought I would find fulfillment in, and guess what? Until I found Christ, they were all empty. I always knew in the back of my heart that it was something that was just still empty. There was something that was still empty. Right after I got saved, there was a young man who asked me, how do you know that this is different? Because he too had tried sex, drugs, and rock and roll and all those things. I said, but this one has life to it. And I've never had a chance to doubt it since. Because I knew, even at that moment, this is a couple-week-old Christian, this has life. The only thing I'd ever found that truly fulfilled the hole that was in my heart. This has life. And we can come because that life is available to us at the throne. We're able to come and freely partake of that which will give us the exchange so those other things can be cast off and the life is put on. It's the power of grace in your life. It's the power of the rest in your life. God's been telling us, and he tells us over and over, yet somehow we continue to miss the point. But he's telling you, I'm not looking for your effort. I'm looking for your surrender. If you're like me, I mean, I have this works mentality. I've got to earn everything, and I have to keep overriding that over and over and say, Lord, I surrender that to you. Because this is not about what I'm doing. This is about who you are and who you called me to be. The righteousness that I walk in is not of me, Lord, it's of you. Because you decided. You made a way. You made it possible. There's nothing I could do that can change my eternal status. Only He can do that. And we understand that when it comes to salvation. But see, every other good gift that is available to us in the same way. Because He's there to be with us and He's there to bring forth that which is necessary, that which is needed, so that you can accomplish the thing He calls you to do. And if you live in sickness and in poverty all your life, you're not going to accomplish what He calls you to do. Even when you have the wrong doctrine, He can still make things happen for you. Look at Mother Teresa. I know everybody's going to stone me, okay? But the deal was, she had the wrong doctrine, because her doctrine said she had to be poor. She took a vow of poverty. Well, that didn't glorify God. But God, in spite of that, glorified Himself. Why? Because the woman had hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars per month that were coming to her because people began to hear about what she was doing and the work that she was accomplishing, and she kept giving it away, and they kept giving her more. She kept giving it away, and they kept giving her more. She kept giving it away, and they kept giving her more. And over and over and over, this woman brought glory to God, even with the wrong doctrine, because God desired to bless her. God accomplished something in His kingdom, not because of her doctrine. He accomplished something in the kingdom because of her stand of faith. Because she was willing to believe Him and willing to receive what He was giving freely. And because it had no stickiness in her own hand. God was able to move in an extraordinary way. Simply because she chose to engage Him. Wonderful thing. But she accomplished things that were well beyond her own ability to do. We have to recognize that God has an inheritance for each of us, and that inheritance goes to bring forth glory for the kingdom. It goes to bring forth a release of something that changes lives in the kingdom around us. He's not looking for our effort. He's looking for our dependence. With Mother Teresa, there was no other way for her to answer. She's in the middle of Calcutta. No money, no phones, no nothing. All she has is a dependence on God. And God answers. When you're sitting in Cali, Colombia, in the Retiro, and the guns are going off all around you, all you have is your dependence on God. Your dependence on God. When somebody brings you a child and the child is distorted and misshapen, there's nothing you can do. All you have is your dependence on God. Your faith that God can do something that we can't. Those are the things that need to motivate us. I spent a number of years fasting. And as I would fast, when I was going through, the thing that brought me through it was looking upon the faces of those children that were being healed. Thinking about me wasn't enough to motivate me through that. But thinking about those children, their lives being changed, for their little faces to suddenly light up because they could see. For their faces to light up because suddenly they can hear. For their faces to light up because suddenly their chromosomes changed and they can respond to the world around them. Those are the things that should motivate us. It's not about our effort. It's about our surrender. See, in the place of surrender, there's great change that can happen. and great intercession that can go forth. Let's go back to Exodus 33. And just to reiterate, his 33 and 14, verse 14 says, "My presence shall go with you, and I will give you rest." See, Moses is in the process of putting up great intercession before the Lord for the people of the nation. For the people of the nation. It's not about him, it's about them. God wasn't fussy with him, but he was certainly fussy with the nation. And God's putting up an intercession for them. He's saying, "This grace that I have found, Lord, is this grace sufficient to cover this situation? Is this grace sufficient to not only cover me, but is it going to cover those who are lost and those who are hurting over here? Is it going to cover those who are outside the realm of your goodwill, Lord?" And the answer is yes. The answer is yes. "Will it cover their sin, Lord?" The answer was yes. The result was an outflow of grace. An outflow of grace. He promises to give them rest. To give them rest. He says, "My presence shall go with you." Grace is not only about just the unmerited favor of God. But grace is about that which accomplishes and engages relationship with the Father. Something that there was no other way for us to accomplish. All the sacrifices that Israel ever put up only gave them a temporary reprieve to make it acceptable, but it never gave them access. "See, my presence shall go with you." I don't believe there's a greater gift than His presence going with you. "I will give you rest." You're not going to have to carry the burden of all those things that you've been carrying. You're not going to have to carry the burden of the bondages that were back in Egypt. You no longer have to carry the burden of the whip and the slavery that was back in Egypt, because I'm going to set you free. I'm going to give you rest. An outflow of grace results in a relationship with God the Father and God the Son, God the Holy Spirit, that we have no other way to initiate than our faith in grace. But what we see now, if we look over down to just, we'll skip down to verse 18. It says, "Pray thee that you would show me your glory." He says, "I'll show you my glory." See, this intercession, and when this grace breaks forth, then there's a breaking forth of the glory of God. When His presence begins to come upon you, there's a breaking forth of the glory of the God that doesn't happen any other way, and it happens through His grace. Chapter 34, we also see what God begins to do for them. A promise that He begins to tell them about. You see, what happens in 34, verse 20, He says, "Behold, I'm going to make a covenant before all your people. I will perform miracles which I have not produced in the earth, nor among any of the nations. And all the people among whom you will live will see the working of the Lord, for it is a fearful thing I'm going to perform with you." He begins to make a new covenant with them. They were just in a place where God was ready to wipe them all out. And now He's saying, because Moses inquired about this grace and the power of grace, He said, "I'll make a covenant with you." Because Moses was bold enough to intercede on the nation's behalf and bring their case to him and say, "What about grace?" And he says, "Now I'll make a covenant with you." So a renewed covenant is a result of rest. The rest that you enter into when you enter into His grace. And then verse 14 goes on and says, "Now be sure to observe what I am commanding you this day. Behold, I'm going to drive out the Amorite before you, and the Canaanite, the Hittite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, and the Jebusite. So we see the ites being driven out. You say, well, Pastor, what does that mean to me? What does that mean to me? Well, see, all these ites represent different things that we battle against. All the ites represent different things. They represent pride and fear. They represent rejection, deception, lack. That's what these ites represent. Control and manipulation. That's what these ites represent. And say, I'm going to go do the battle for you. I will do the battle for you. I personally, the Lord, will go forth before you and make this happen. So the very things that we had our cares all wrapped up in, when we'll submit to Him, when we'll put our dependence upon Him, He goes before us to respond to those situations. He goes before us. Every care that we could potentially have, He already said, I'm going to take care of the ites for you. I'm going to go into the promised land, and in the promised land, I'm going to take care of the ites. All the cares are driven out by His hand. When we enter into His rest, you know what we're really doing? We're entering into a trust relationship. We're entering into a trust relationship because no longer is my trust being in the thing that I've given voice to, that care, that worry, that concern, that torment, that anxiety, whatever it was. My trust can now be in my God. And my God responds by driving out those things. All the ites that were attacking me. All the ites that were dispossessing me from my land. From my inheritance. That's what He wants us to understand. Our dependence upon the Lord makes us so we're no longer devourable by the enemy. Why? Because we find a place in God's love. Love answers all things. First John 4 tells us that there's no torment in love. When we truly discover the love of God, we can look over there, I think it's 4:18. When we truly discover the love of God, there's no torment. 1 John 4. See, when we abide, what's rest? Rest is abiding. Verse 16. We've come to know and believe the love which God has for us. God is love, and the one who abides in love abides in God. He rests in God. And God rests in Him, abides in Him. And by this abiding, by this resting, by this, love is perfected with us that we may have confidence in the day of judgment, because as He is, so are we in this world. And there's no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear, because fear involves punishment or torment. And with the one who fears is not perfected in love. Perfect love casts out all the fear, because in perfect love there's a sanctuary that's established around you. There's a sanctuary established over your heart that nothing else can penetrate, because you know, the abiding love of God is there for you. The abiding love of God stands with you and over you, and it begins to permeate every part of your senses. And so that those things in your senses that were responding to the situations that the ites were presenting no longer respond to that. It's almost like an anesthesia that comes over those things to where you're aware that they're happening, but they don't have a pull on you anymore. Just like Christ said, Satan is coming for me, but he has nothing in me. He has nothing in me. When I begin to understand this rest that God has for me, when I begin to understand His grace, I can also begin to understand and step into the place where Satan has nothing in me. Because I understand the love of God has so wrapped me up. It's so surrounded me and secluded me from the assault and the attack of the enemy. It's like you're in a dome. You can see the things going on around you, but they don't affect the emotion in the same way. You come because there's now a place of trust that is being released. There's a place of trust that He's got this. And the end result, He's got this. I don't have to worry. I don't have to put my hand to it. He's got this. I put my hand to trusting my Lord. Because he's got this. And then you can begin to come into that place where the peace of God passes all understanding. Because now the ites are being taken care of. The assault of the enemy is being taken care of. And the love of God is surrounding your heart and insulating you from all those things. All of a sudden, now you know that no matter what's happening, I'm not lining up under the bridge. No matter what's happening, I don't have to deal with those things because God has got it in His hand. I no longer have to worry about letting the enemy take me way past what's even realistic. I can begin to understand that the situation is in God's hand. Because I'm trusting in His grace. I'm allowing His grace to come and manifest that which was called to manifest, which is the true will of God for my life. He's not looking for our efforts. He's looking for our surrender. He's looking for our trust. He's not worried about our sin. He's worried about our unbelief. Because our unbelief is the only thing that separates us from coming into His presence. It's the only thing that separates us from being able to stand with Him and allow Him to go to work on the ites for us. He's got it in His hands. It's interesting that promise that He gave there in Exodus 34 and 10 about driving out the ites, He repeats it almost word for word in Joshua 3 and 10. Because He is wanting to make sure that they understood that this covenant was for them. Because see, the very first group didn't actually get to go in because of other situations that happened. But God said, this covenant, I'm not letting go of. I give it to my people freely. At the throne of grace, He gives it to you freely. Verse 16 of Hebrews 4. Let us therefore draw near with confidence to the throne of grace, that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need. Grace to help in time of need. When we're looking at help, we have find that place of the grace to help. That means we're no longer having to do it on our own. If I call someone up here to help me, that means I'm not going to be doing it all on my own. I got someone else who's bearing the burden with me. When that someone else bearing the burden with you is the Father Himself, how much better can it get? When that someone with you bearing the burden is Jesus Christ, the burden bearer, how much better can it get? Well, if you're going to be knit to any cord, how about being knit to the threefold cord of the Holy Ghost, the Father, and the Son? How much better can it get? To know that His grace is the place of His trust. His grace is the place of His rest. His grace is the place where love and His compassion can begin to intersect on your life. Hallelujah. Amen. I think we got it for today.